The Supreme Court has extended its term into July for the first time since 1996. Today, the court made major rulings banning cell phone robocalls and allowing states to punish faithless electors. That's members of the Electoral College who would go against the popular vote of their state. But there are still several much anticipated cases that are outstanding. So, to give us a rundown on this important week for the court, we have WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. Hi, Kimberly.
Hi, Tiziana.
It's Monday. Apparently, I can't speak well, so sorry about that, Kimberly.
We all suffer from it.
Try to get our way. Exactly. And it is July, and here we are talking about waiting for more rulings or even hearing about rulings from the Supreme Court today. How did we get here?
Yeah, the coronavirus affected the Supreme Court like it affected all of us. It's not since the 90s that the court's term has extended past the end of June. Usually that's the benchmark for the ending of it. But at the height of the pandemic, the court had to pause having oral arguments and close its building for several weeks. And then ultimately, usually the court wraps up arguments in April, by mid-April, but they had to end up having arguments take place in May for 10 of its cases to finish all of its work. So by pushing that out by about a month, that's causing them to go out and it take them a little longer to finish writing all the remaining opinions.
And the telecom part was unprecedented as well, right? That was brand new.
It really was. I mean, there has long been a push to have the court broadcast its arguments live, and it's refused to do so, but it was forced to because they did the arguments via conference call with the attorneys in the cases, and it was broadcast on C-SPAN and other news organizations. So that was very different, and we'll have more conversations in the future about, well, now that that's, you know, that has been done, is it going to happen more in the future?
All right, so two cases today. The one I want to focus on first is faithless electors, which seems particularly important in an election year. Can you kind of give us the background? What was at issue in this case?
Yeah, so about two-thirds of states in the country, including Massachusetts, have laws that require electors, members of the Electoral College, to vote according to the popular vote within that state. And about 15 of those laws, including two at issue in this case, have some sort of enforcement mechanism, some sort of penalty that the electors will face or that they'll be replaced. And it was a challenge to the constitutionality of those laws penalizing electors. The Supreme Court found unanimously that states can pass laws that force electors to vote according to what the voters say. Elena Kagan, writing for the court, said both the Constitution and history back that up. She talked about the famous election between Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, how that ended up in a tie and the chaos that ensued. Of course, she had to do a mandatory reference to Hamilton, which many of us watched over the weekend, and also to the TV show Veep. So she had a little fun with it. But in the end, states can enforce these laws.
Is this something particularly important? Will it have tangible effect on 2020? We're in a presidential election year.
Yeah, you know, it's unclear how much of an impact it will have on 2020. If it's close, then yes. I mean, what one reason why this decision was unanimous, I think, was because both Democrats and Republicans, this is one of those rare issues that they agreed on, both parties wanted to be able to really force their electors to vote according to the votes of the people, because if not, in a close vote, it can really result in chaos, right? If you have a handful of electors who decide to go rogue, so to speak, and cast their votes any way that they wanted, it could have a big impact on the outcome. So maybe this year will be that close. We'll have to wait and see, but it certainly could cause some problems in the future.
So five cases still outstanding. One in particular people are really watching for, right?
Yes, people are waiting to see if President Trump will have to release his financial records in compliance with subpoenas issued both by New York State and by the House of Representatives. This case is a big deal, not just because it may allow us to see finally President Trump's tax returns, but also it tests the limits of executive power, the power power of the presidency. The president is essentially saying because he is president, he can stop Congress and he can stop federal prosecutors from executing a duly authorized subpoena that otherwise would have to be adhered to. So it's a big deal in a lot of ways.
All right. So one more question about the court. There's a rumor from conservative radio host Hugh Hewitt that Justice Samuel Alito is mulling retirement. About a week ago, Washington Post reported that Justice Clarence Thomas, quote, is privately seen by Trump's aides as the most likely to retire this year, end quote. Any truth to either of those speculations?
There is no fact that has been put out by any justice indicating any intent to retire. In fact, Clarence Thomas has repeatedly said that he will not. What this is possibly messaging. Every election year, we hear about the rumble, will a justice step down? The same thing happened with Ruth Bader Ginsburg at the end of President Obama's second term. It's sometimes wishful thinking, particularly if, and in this case with Hugh Hewitt, it's posited by someone who is on the same side and perhaps wants to see Alito retire, but there's no indication yet that that will happen.
Okay, before we let you go, I do want to talk a little bit about the president. He spoke twice over the holiday weekend, once at Mount Rushmore, again at the White House. Here's President Trump in front of the White House on July 4th.
We will never allow an angry mob to tear down our statues, erase our history, indoctrinate our children, or trample on our freedoms.
That represented a theme that he struck both days, really taking on the media, sort of a nondescript left that he was standing against. We talked a lot last year at this time, Kimberly, about the politicization of the 4th of July. What's the response today in Washington to the president's comments and whether they were appropriate for a president on the 4th of July in a presidential address?
Well, lucky for Republicans, Congress is out for a two-week recess, so they weren't asked about these comments by reporters on the Hill. But, you know, the president has been digging deep in this race-based cultural war leading into his reelection bid. As part of his reelection bid, it's sort of an extension on one hand of comments that he's been making really about these monuments in this way since Charlottesville. But it's also a fact that he had intended to run on the economy, and the economy is not doing so well. So he seems to be doubling down, tripling down on this sort of division, fueling this cultural division as part of his reelection bid. And it was another example of that this weekend.
The president also said over the weekend, and I'm going to paraphrase here, that 99% of coronavirus cases are totally harmless. That's also obviously caused some stir. Any reactions that you're hearing to that? Again, understanding that Congress is not in session right now.
Right. Well, it's untrue. Over the weekend, even the president's own FDA commissioner had to say that that was not true on the Sunday shows. Just sort of that the fight that within the own administration of trying to message and say things that are true against things that the president says that are in fact not true. It has been tough. The president certainly wants the coronavirus to go away and wants it to be less dangerous and less deadly than it is. But there is no science behind that assertion.
And we are in an election year. Anything from former Vice President and presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden on all of this?
Yeah, so Joe Biden was striking a much different chord over the holiday weekend. You know, he talked about sharing in the American dream and a battle of the soul of the nation. It sort of sets up the different messaging that you're going to see from both of them until the election about what their vision of America is. And I think we'll hear a lot more of that from the vice president in the months ahead.
All right. That's WBUR senior news correspondent Kimberly Atkins. I appreciate you being with us today, Kimberly. Thank you.
My pleasure.
Eviction cases are expected to soar in Massachusetts as housing relief measures and pandemic unemployment benefits expire this summer. The state could extend the eviction moratorium, but critics say that would hurt small landlords. In the latest of WBUR's bilingual collaboration with the newspaper El Planeta, reporter Simone Rios explores some of the solutions being considered to prevent an eviction crisis in the state.
Carolina lives in East Boston with her husband and four kids. Her baby was born at the start of the pandemic in March. They lost their cleaning jobs shortly after the birth. Because she and her husband are undocumented, the family can't get the kind of federal benefits that have helped others in the state keep up with their rent. As a mother, I'm very concerned about not having money to pay the rent, she says. My kids have watched me crying, and they've asked if we'll have to live on the streets. We've agreed to use only Carolina's first name because the family fears legal repercussions due to the couple's immigration status. Now the family owes $6,000 for 3 months in back rent, and the landlord has threatened to take legal action. Carolina says landlords need to understand the situation tenants are facing. It's not that we want to live for free, she says. We can't work now, and we've never been short on the rent before. In normal times, the family might be facing eviction. But renters across the state are protected by a moratorium on evictions that's been in place for the last 3 months. That's set to expire on August 18th, and advocates say Massachusetts could see a massive wave of evictions that would hit hardest in black and brown neighborhoods. Advocates want to extend the moratorium, saying it's a public health necessity during the pandemic. But critics say that would be devastating for some landlords. Carlene Sherry walks through the two-family house she owns in Dorchester. She says one of her tenants stopped paying the rent in March. The woman on the first floor hands Sherry a wad of cash, $2,000. Sherry counts it and then peels off $100 to give back as a goodwill gesture.
For the baby.
Okay, thank you.
I saw three beds in there once. And then, of course, the AC, that's when they're going to put out the window.
On the second floor, the tenants cited the evictions moratorium as a justification for not paying, even though they appear to be working. The moratorium doesn't mean they can live rent-free. It's just that Sherry can't evict them, even though they owe her $10,000 in back rent.
It's like everything I'm trying to do, it's working against me because they know the law. I can't evict them. I'm forced to sell.
Sherry says after 4 months in the red, she wants out of the property, and she has a buyer, only she can't close until the tenant who's not paying moves out, and there's no indication that's going to happen anytime soon. Sherry says if the rent moratorium is extended, legislators should create a mechanism to prevent bad faith tenants from abusing the law. And she's not alone, according to Doug Quattracci, head of the advocacy group Mass Landlords.
So there's a lot of frustrated landlords who do feel like the eviction moratorium, by being so broad, you don't have to prove you're impacted by COVID. It's just enabled some people to take advantage. We don't think it's many, but it's enough.
Quattracci says about 5% of his members are unable to pay their bills and are ready to sell. And another 20% don't know how they're going to make ends meet at the end of this year. State lawmakers are considering a bill that would extend the eviction moratorium through next August. It would also create a relief fund to help landlords collect rent lost because of the pandemic. Clark Ziegler, head of the quasi-governmental Massachusetts Housing Partnership, says stopping evictions alone won't solve the underlying problem.
Which is that it costs money to operate, to provide housing. And, you know, in addition to, you know, mortgage expenses, there's utilities and insurance and maintenance and so on. And so, unless we sort of replace this lost income at some scale, it's hard to imagine other interventions that are going to be very effective.
To keep the rental market afloat, Ziegler says, tenants need hundreds of millions of dollars in state or federal aid over the course of a year-long moratorium. Last month, Democrats in Congress proposed a new stimulus bill that would include $100 billion in rental assistance and ban all evictions for 12 months. But it's made little progress in the Senate. On the state level, the Baker administration announced a new $20 million rental and mortgage assistance program. Quattracci from Mass Landlords says we need to think bigger, far bigger. He wants to see a new tax directed at single-family zoning that would generate enough money to guarantee rents are paid until the pandemic comes to an end.
That report from WBUR Simon Rios. You can find a Spanish-language version of this story and others at WBUR.org. Ibram X. Kendi is an award-winning best-selling scholar on race. On July 1st, he officially joined Boston University's faculty and is the founding head of a new Center for Anti-Racist Research there. And I should just mention, Boston University does hold the broadcasting license for WBUR. Now, while discussions with Kendi happened over a period of a year, his and the center's arrival could not be more timely, as Boston and the country enter the third month in which protests are happening over racism, police brutality, and the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police. Ibram X. Kendi, historian and author most recently of How to Be an Anti-Racist, joins us on the line now. Professor Kendi, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you for having me on the show.
It's a pleasure to have you. I want to start with a question you actually probably get a lot, but you have completely reframed the racist versus not a racist, rejecting the idea that not a racist is really even a thing. You argue there's racist and anti-racist. Could you explain for our listeners what that distinction is?
Sure. So I think it's critically important for us to realize there are ideas that suggest racial hierarchy, that certain racial groups are better or worse than others, and those are racist ideas. And then there are ideas that suggest racial equality, and those are anti-racist ideas. There are policies that are leading to racial inequity, and those are racist, and there are policies leading to racial equity, and those are anti-racist. As you can see, there's really no place for not racist ideas or race-neutral policies. You know, our ideas and our policies are either being racist or anti-racist. And when we are expressing or supporting or challenging or defending those policies or ideas, that's when we're being racist or anti-racist as well.
Your book, the most recent one, How to Be an Anti-Racist, really comes from a place of deep personal narrative. It's striking. What made you decide to put your own personal development at the heart of your argument as you lay out your thesis in that book?
Sure. So, you know, as you sort of ask about the heart of my argument, that the heart of being anti-racist, the heartbeat of anti-racism itself is confession, because really it's the heartbeat of racism is denial, and the sound of that denial is, I'm not racist. The sound of the confession is, you know what, I was being racist when I said that there was something wrong with Latinx immigrants or Black people. And so I wanted that confession. I wanted that vulnerability. I wanted that self-reflection to really be the pulse of the book. And I realized that I could sort of use my own story to do that.
One of the things that you teach about that just seems so, I don't know, important for the moment is you talk about moving away from terms like structural or institutional racism and instead explicitly calling out and using the term racist policies. It has been clear since quite early on in the coronavirus pandemic that it hits communities of color and vulnerable populations disproportionately hard. I wonder if you would argue that there are racist policies behind that disparity, and if so, if this is a place where you could give us an example or two of what a racist policy is.
Sure. And so I advocate for us to, I still use terms sometimes like structural and systemic racism, but racism is essentially structural and systemic. And also, when we speak to everyday people, when we say structural racism, they may not understand what that means, but if we say racist policies or a series of racist policies, that is more, you know, they can really wrap their heads around that and the way that's impacting their lives. And so in the case of COVID-19, we, for instance, know that more predictive of black people being disproportionately infected and dying of COVID than even their pre-existing conditions is air and water quality of neighborhoods, is access to health insurance, is access to high-quality care, and is employment status. And so those past zoning policies that have led to black and even brown communities being more likely to be near transfer stations or to be essentially polluted are a form of racist policies that are then leading to these disparities.
Let's talk a little now about this new Center for Anti-Racist Research. We know that there's been a long history between academic research, data-driven research, and policy development or formation in the U.S. You, I know, are interested in data science to quantify racist policies and their impact. I also know it's true that there's been concern for a while that big data, quote-unquote, might actually include implicit bias that would disadvantage vulnerable populations in research. So how are you thinking about big data, data science, and some of the questions that you both can and want to use data to answer through the research of this center?
So I think possibly the best way to answer this is to talk a little bit about what we mean when we say anti-racist research. And so racist research, when there's inequities and injustices, ask the question, well, what's wrong with people? You know, how can we figure out a way to change these people, civilize these people? What's wrong with people? That's the fundamental research question of racist research. When it comes to anti-racist research and there's inequity and injustice, the fundamental research question is, what's wrong with policies? What's wrong with conditions? What's wrong with structures and systems? And so part of the way in which we even see that there's a problem is by having racial data. And racial data and its collection and its presentation can either be done in a racist or anti-racist form. And so you have some data scientists who just imagine that that data is just removed from human consideration in the way they consider AI to not have the possibility to be inherently racist or anti-racist, because it's made
by humans. AI being artificial intelligence.
Precisely. And anything made by humans can be racist or anti-racist.
You know, you can't say Boston and racism without thinking of our city's reputation. And Boston has historically had a reputation for being a very racist city. A lot of high-profile Black comedians, athletes, broadcasters have told stories in recent years about that. In reading How to Be an Anti-Racist, I was struck that you seem to have been pretty intentional about where you've chosen to live at times in your life. And also, it seems that where you live has affected who you are as a person, how you see and think about the world and your research. So was Boston an intentional choice? And how do you think being in Boston with its history will affect or shape that work?
When I think of Boston right now, I think of a place that sits at the nexus of some of the, with one of the largest, if not the largest concentration of scholars who are studying racism in the country, if not the world. And so that's what I see. And I also see a place that certainly, you know, you have racial disparities here. And those racial disparities are appalling. And if you have a city with racial disparities, you're going to have racism. But I've never lived in a city that wasn't racist in the United States. And then finally, you know, when I think of Boston, I think of a city that in the 19th century was the beacon of the anti-slavery movement. And so why can't we make Boston in the 21st century the beacon of the anti-racist movement?
You know, you have written about the relationship between protests, demonstrations, change in racist policies, arguing, if I understand you correctly, to some extent that rather than starting with hearts and minds, start with policy change and hearts and minds will follow. So given that we are in our third month of seeing protests and demonstrations about racist policies, police brutality, the death of George Floyd, where should the focus and the push be next? What should come next?
Well, we should be razor focused on not only demonstrating the problem through our demonstrations on the streets, but ensuring that it's then leading to power and policy change. And I think that should be, you know, at the forefront of our sort of struggle.
You know, before we let you go, we've just come off of the 4th of July weekend. Here on Radio Boston, we've talked quite a bit in the last couple of weeks about the relationship between Juneteenth and the 4th of July, recognizing that the 4th of July does mark independence, a moment of independence for our country, but not for everyone in our country, and also reflecting on how to think about observing Juneteenth. Can you reflect on that a little bit for us, how you're seeing the relationship between the two holidays and what you think the right posture to those two things as a country should be right now?
So I think, obviously, I believe Juneteenth should be a national holiday. It should be a holiday in which we reflect and remember this nation's history of enslavement, and certainly for Black people to really reflect on the emancipation from chattel slavery. And I think July 4th should be a day not in which we celebrate as if we are all free, but a day of resistance and protest where we're demonstrating and protesting for every American to have the power to be free.
It has been a tough year, to put it mildly. Where do you find your hope? Where are you getting your joy and inspiration right now?
So I'm hopeful because I believe you have to believe change is possible in order to bring it about.
And that is Ibram X. Kendi, historian, author of How to Be an Anti-Racist, and director and founder of the new Center for Anti-Racist Research at Boston University. Welcome to the community, and thanks so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on.
Now, unless you live in Boston or Somerville, Phase 3 of the Commonwealth's reopening begins today. So what does that mean, both in terms of who can reopen and whether they will? On the line to tell us about is WBUR Senior Statehouse reporter Steve Brown. Steve, welcome back.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, what gets the okay starting today?
Yeah, you can go to gyms, fitness centers, movie theaters, museums, cultural and historical sites, along with sightseeing tours, casinos can all reopen as of today. But as we've seen in phases one and two, there will be sector-specific restrictions. You got to wear a face covering. You got to keep socially distanced. There'll be a couple of steps in this phase, by the way. Activities with low potential for contact, such as batting cages, driving ranges, go-karts, bowling alleys, those can all open now. Step two includes activities with greater potential for contact. Think of things like laser tag, roller skating, trampolines. Those will all get underway later in phase three, but the exact date depends on the health data that comes in.
You know, Steve, I hadn't thought about it until I was listening to you sort of lay all that out just now. It feels like this is a sort of an exercise or physical activity intensive phase. Is that true, or is that just my perception?
I think, you know, a few more of these things, are a little more active now, whereas phase one and two were more sedentary. You know, maybe you could go into your office so long as only, you know, less than 25% of the people could be there, things like that, things where everybody kind of keeps their distance. Obviously, roller skating, we might bump into each other.
Good point. Now, we said at the top that Boston, Somerville, they don't start for another week. Why is that? And why has Somerville joined Boston this time? We've seen delays for Boston before.
Yeah, remember that while the state sets the guidelines, it's up to the local communities to enforce those guidelines. And Boston and Somerville just feel that they need an extra week to work with the businesses in their communities to get it right. So therefore, that's why they're having the week-long delay.
Okay, and let's be clear. Just because businesses can open doesn't necessarily mean they will, right? I mean, we still have seen some businesses that were authorized to open in phase two who have decided not to, either out of an abundance of caution or because the scale at which they'd be allowed to open might not be profitable for them. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. One of my favorite restaurants near where I live is still closed. They were open for curbside for a while, then they closed saying we're going to get set for reopening, and they're still getting set, I guess. Ultimately, it's up to the businesses themselves to decide when they want to reopen once they've been given the go-ahead by the state for that sector to open. Some businesses might be taking it a little longer to get everything lined up, or they may not feel comfortable bringing their staff in. It just varies from business to business.
Steve, you cover the State House. What are you hearing around the State House about the level of comfort or discomfort about the pace at which Massachusetts is reopening, especially given what's going on with surges in other parts of the country?
Sure. I haven't heard anything in the building for a while. Of course, everyone here is really working remotely, so it's not like I can hear grumbling out in the hallway here. There was some criticism before phase one got underway back in May from both sides, saying some were saying that the state is going too slow and others were saying that the state was going too fast. Governor Baker has acknowledged that he's going to get flack from both sides no matter what. But I must say it has quieted down significantly since the process got underway about 2 months ago.
So, Steve, in a couple of minutes, we're going to have some doctors on who are going to talk to us about more about that subject. And I do want to flag for our listeners real quick. They will also take your coronavirus call. So call in 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with what questions you have about the phase three reopening, about safety, about contagion and spread, et cetera. To that point, Steve, the governor says he is a little worried about the state moving backward in our fight against the virus. How is the state going to be monitoring that, and what would cause them to scale back the reopening? They haven't done that at any stage yet.
No. Every day, the Department of Public Health puts out their dashboard of public health indicators. And right at the top, there are about a half dozen metrics listed that are the key data points. Their positive test rate, the number of people who died from COVID-19, the number of patients in the hospital with COVID-19, healthcare system readiness, testing capacity, and contact tracing capacities. Now, think of each of those having a green, yellow, or red light. If the lights are green or yellow, the reopening plan moves forward. But if a trend starts to turn negative, say a red light, so to speak, goes yellow, that's when I would expect that a possible retreat in the reopening procedure.
And Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't believe we've had any moment in the dashboard yet where it's been all greens, right? We're still at a combination of green and yellow.
And we probably won't get all greens. One of the things is, the death rate. And so long as there is a single death, then that is not going to be green. That's always going to be a yellow light. So until that, that's a long way away. But conversely, since they started doing this, we haven't gone anything back to red. So that's a good sign for now. But as soon as you start seeing that, then they're going to start thinking about maybe we need to tweak this or tweak that. And how they do that remains to be seen. That'll be up to the governor and his administration.
All right. We will keep watching alongside you. That's WBUR Senior State House Reporter Steve Brown. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
All right, so as phase three gets underway, we have many more questions, and we know you do too, about what this could mean for the potential spread of COVID-19. We want to have more of that conversation today. So we have another panel of local health experts to help answer our questions and yours. Remember, you can call in at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. So joining us to help with the conversation today is Dr. Shira Daron, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Welcome back, Dr. Daron.
Great to be back.
And also with us is Professor Lenny Marcus, founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Welcome back to you too, Lenny Marcus.
Well, glad to be with you.
All right, and I'm going to ask you both this question. Maybe Dr. Daron, you can answer first, but I really want to hear from both of you. How are you feeling about the fact that we have started phase three this week? Dr. Daron, maybe you go first.
Well, I am feeling lucky. I'm feeling lucky to be a resident of Massachusetts right now. I feel like our governor and our government have really listened to the experts, have adhered to the plans that were set forth, and have really crushed that curve in every possible way. And so I think I'm excited that we are able to be in phase three.
Professor Marcus, how about you?
Well, I second what Dr. Daron said. And in particular, we can learn a lot about best case and worst case scenarios when we look at what's going on in other states and other countries. And Massachusetts has taken such a different strategy from states like Florida, Texas, Arizona. And we see the results of the policies that were put in place there and the impact that it's had on their dashboards. So yes, feel very fortunate that we live here in Massachusetts and do hope that we all will recognize that we made a huge investment in getting to this point. And there were sacrifices in getting to this point. And I hope that everyone in the Commonwealth will continue what we've been doing so that we'll be able to march forward in reopening our economy.
All right, let's go to the phones, 1-800-423-8255. To ask your question, we have Jeanette on the line from Northborough. Jeanette, go ahead. What's your question?
Hi, thanks. I don't know who's going to answer this, but my question is, when do Alcoholics Anonymous meetings start taking place in person? Because I know individuals, I've worked in a homeless shelter, and there are people not able to do Zoom AA calls. So I'm wondering when they can reconvene.
Great question. Dr. Durone, what do you know about that?
That is so hard. And there are so many people recovering from drug and alcohol addiction that need those meetings so badly. And you're right, Zoom just doesn't cut it for some types of interactions. But I do not know where that fits into the plan.
And I think it's those meetings are very important. And so think creatively. It's possible, if people are willing to do it, to hold meetings outside. So if people are outside with a mask, with social distance, making a very big circle, everyone brings their own chair, for example, in a park, it's possible, again, thinking very creatively about finding opportunities to hold very important meetings like that, because especially in a case like this, being able to be with other people is a real plus. So if we can find ways to safely be with other people for that scenario as well as others, it's just a good thing for all of us.
Very true.
You know, hearing Jeanette's question and hearing both of your answers makes me want to ask again about the mental health implications of the level of social distancing, isolation, inability to be with people that you love or the support networks that you care about. And are we as a state, as a Commonwealth, as a country, paying sufficient attention to that? And how will we understand what the public health impacts of that will be now and over time?
Well, people who work in mental health have placed a great deal of attention on the impact that it's having on all of us, including mental health professionals. And that's why it's really important for us to keep driving forward, being very, very careful. I think it would be very demoralizing at this point for us to have reached this, you know, to this level, phase three, and then to blow it and then have to go backwards. That would just be very, very difficult, which is why it's really important for us to recognize step by step we're moving forward. And depending on your individual risk profile, and depending on how much risk you're able to take, getting together with people outdoors, it's a wonderful time of year for that. Making sure to wear a mask, keep social distancing. Those are all things that we can think about creatively, and they will allow us to address some of that forlornness that I think we're all feeling, having been in this situation for so long.
Dr. Durone, building on that. Oh, yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think the combination right now of the good weather and where we are on the curve. In other words, a 1.8% test positivity rate in Massachusetts, which means that if you do get together with a small group of people, well distanced and outside, the chance that any one of them has asymptomatic COVID disease is low. Both of those things make this time right now the right time to get out and do some careful socializing.
Let's actually grab another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your phase three reopening or coronavirus question. We have Susan on the line from Andover. Susan, what's your question?
Hi, mine is more just of the spread. I have a question about, does the virus live on clothing? Because I've read a lot that sometimes the advice will be, when you get home from the grocery store, wash your clothes, you know, take your clothing off right away. And I just wanted to confirm that. It just seems, I don't know, I've been reading conflicting things. I wanted to see what people's advice was about that.
Thanks, Susan. Who would like to answer that one?
I'll start. Yeah. Conflicting is right. So, you know, even just the fact that in the hospital, healthcare workers wear gowns to cover their clothes, which sort of suggests that maybe the clothing is going to be a major determinant of spread. And really, we don't think that's the case. The virus doesn't survive all that well on anything for long periods of time, and it really doesn't like textiles at all. I personally do not take off my clothes and wash them right away when I come home. Certainly any washer or detergent that you use is going to easily kill the virus, but I would not worry too much that it will get off your clothing and onto anything else in your house or onto your hands and create and cause disease.
You know, our chance of bumping into someone who has the disease here in Massachusetts keeps going down as the numbers of cases go down. I was speaking with my niece yesterday in Arizona, and that's a very different scenario where there are so many cases. They're spiraling upwards. So the fact that the chances of our bumping into someone with COVID-19 at this point are lower allows us not to be as careful, concerned, or anxious as we were in the first weeks of this disease.
So this was something I was kind of thinking about asking you after the last caller and your answer there. But in listening to the two of you again, what is the balancing act between recognizing that and taking the kind of hope or relief from what you're saying and making sure that it doesn't move us into being less vigilant than we should be about wearing masks and face coverings, about being socially distanced, especially as the emotional and social fatigue of that continues to wear on. You know, the Globe reported that according to a poll conducted June 18th through the 21st by Suffolk University, there was about a decline of 25 percentage points from early May in people who say that they are being very strict about social distancing.
Yeah, well, quarantine fatigue is real. And we still have to follow all the rules. And so, you know, what we don't need to worry so much about is, as Dr. Marcus was saying, is the extras that people might have been doing, the wiping down of the grocery bags, you know, the taking off your shoes at the door, you know, some of the stuff that was, you know, questionable in the first place. This is the time to relax on some of those things. But we do have to follow the rules about distancing, the rules about masks when you can't keep your distance, and especially inside, and the hand hygiene. You know, those are the most important things, and we can't stop doing that. And we only need to look at the curves from some of the other states that are not very far away to know what can happen if we stop doing those things.
I agree with what Dr. Daron just said. Yesterday, my wife and I went grocery shopping. We followed exactly the same rules that we did on week one. The main difference was we were just less anxious about it, and that felt a lot better, and we were able to smile through our grocery shopping. So that's thanks to a lot of hard work that we've all accomplished over these last 4 weeks. So therefore, really important that we keep that up.
Let's go to another call, 800-423-8255. We have Dave on the line from Yarmouth. Dave, what's your question?
Well, before we start patting ourselves on the back, remember 8,000 people died in this state from this disease, and over 50,000 have died in the Northeast from this disease. So we have to remember that. But my main question is about the aerosol spray, for lack of a better term, that the argument is going on that a lot of scientists or some scientists want the CDC and WHO to say that it's spread that way. And what you're feeling about that, considering that we've had the disease now for 3 months, and have we seen that type of thing? Because we would have seen a lot more infections, wouldn't we, if it transferred that way?
Thanks for the question, Dave. And just to round that out a little bit more, we know in reporting, for example, in the Boston Globe, that 239 scientists from 32 countries wrote an open letter to the WHO outlining some evidence showing that these smaller particles can infect people. And they're calling for more research in this area. What can the two of you tell us about that?
Yeah, great, great question. And also thank you for the reminder about the devastating numbers that we have seen here in Massachusetts. And while we can be proud of our accomplishments, we did have quite a surge here in the state, and we lost a lot of Massachusetts residents. So in terms of the question of airborne versus droplet transmission of an infection, there's a lot of talk about this over the weekend, and there's really been a lot of talk about this from the very beginning. The issue comes down to the fact that it really isn't a dichotomy it isn't the case that there are strictly droplet transmission organisms and strictly airborne transmission organisms. And that's why sometimes we get all kind of jumbled up in our discussions about this. It is not a truly airborne disease the way measles and tuberculosis are. And we know that based on the epidemiology. We know that based on the fact that we have not seen, you know, people transmit to others through a building's HVAC system, for example. We know from the Diamond Princess cruise ship attack rate, which was about 19%, that, you know, even people in very, very close quarters for a prolonged period of time did not transmit at a rate that you would expect from an airborne disease. That being said, we also see the type of transmission that can't be explained strictly by large droplets that should only be able to travel for 6 feet. And so there's probably a continuum when it comes to disease transmission, where the virus sometimes doesn't follow the 6 foot rule. And that is probably when you are in close contact with somebody who isn't coughing or sneezing, so droplets aren't being created. So that's a close range aerosol. And it's also probably happening in situations where there's enclosed space, poor ventilation, and for some reason, a lot of virus, like singing or exercising or yelling, or someone or more than one someone who might have a high viral load because of where they are in the disease. So a lot of factors that can come together to create something that looks more like what we think about when we talk about airborne transmission than droplet, but not a truly airborne type of disease transmission in the true sense of the word.
So Professor Marcus, we have about a minute left. I'm leaving a bunch of callers unable to get their calls in, but I do want to ask one question. One caller wanted to know how we should deal with people coming back from vacations from other states, especially states with high infection rates right now.
You know, there's a term that we use in Homeland Security that says, see something, say something. So if we find that somebody's not wearing a mask, coming back from a vacation and not being careful on their return, then we all have a collective responsibility to, you know, see something, say something. And in a very polite and encouraging and understanding way, just make sure that we're all on board with the same program.
All right. And callers, I'm sorry I couldn't get to all of you today. We will do this again, so just keep listening. In the meantime, that was Professor Lenny Marcus, founding co-director of the National Preparedness Leadership Initiative. Thanks, Professor Marcus.
Thank you.
And Dr. Shira Daron, an infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. It was good to have you back again, Dr. Daron. Thank you.
Thanks so much.